This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
He is community activist, community educator, and co-sponsor or co-coordinator, I should say, of the King Day celebration, Mr. Michael Chappie Grass. We'll be right back in just a moment. Take this opportunity to welcome Michael Chappie Grass to the microphones here today, and of course he only takes a village in KBOO. Michael, just want to start just a little bit differently today. We're going to talk about the upcoming King Day celebration, and I believe this is your 27th, isn't it?
This will be our 28th, actually. Last year was the 27th, this month's our 28th.
Okay.
And consecutive.
Consecutive, okay. And this is the biggest, I believe, celebration here in the Northwest, isn't it?
It is. Okay. It's one of the biggest in the United States. We second only to Atlanta, and we compete with San Francisco for innovation.
Okay. Just a minute here. We have to get these... Yeah, get the levels right here, I think.
Well, thank you for having me, Brother Hamid.
The pleasure's all mine. It's been an honor working with your organization for the last 27 years and the work that you're doing. So I'm going to thank you for your participation and, of course, the energy of Mr. Ken Berry.
Exactly.
And the work that he does. As I mentioned at the outset of the program, we're going to start just a little bit different. The current state of the black community, when we look at the legacy of Dr. King, and as we hold up the legacy with this celebration, how do you view the current state of black leadership today?
Well, it's robust. It takes a little different form than it took in years past, and that, I think, sometimes throws people. It makes it look like there's not the kind of bold leadership that we've had in past years, both at the national and the regional and local level. But indeed, it's taken a little bit different form, where you have smaller organizations that are doing very effective work, and particularly in the ecumenical community. And also in our small business community, the demographics have changed, and that affects things. But I'm careful not to always describe our community in terms of the problems that we have.
Mm-hmm.
If you describe your community only in the terms of the problems that you have a problem community. But if you dig just a little deeper, if you peel back just a couple layers, what you're going to find is some people who have been doing an outstanding job for a very long period of time, who get very little credit. Both inside the schools, inside the churches, inside law enforcement, inside the district attorney's office, and those people that aid and support and advocate for and help deliver quality that is the benefit to African-American community are both African-American and European-American, both Asian-American and Latino-American. It's a matter now of cultivating leadership, particularly in our young people and in the generation that it maybe is just behind our generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions, I think one of the traditional questions I know that I know that I've asked, and most likely probably others have asked, when this holiday comes around, is what would he say, or what would Dr. King, and we want to always kind of maintain that focus and look in terms of his legacy and in terms of the work in the direction that he was taking the community. You know, when we look at, like you said, we don't necessarily want to focus on the problems, but unemployment is obviously a problem, not only to African-Americans, but to Americans in general. Drug addiction, homelessness. We have a disproportionate amount of folks in the jails and prisons and so forth. A disproportionate amount of African-Americans, particularly here locally and nationally. And one of your interests in terms of education, you know, these are areas that is difficult to really kind of gloss over. So when you look at what he would think and what he would say, what do you think he would feel about the state of Black America in those terms?
Well, education is a priority. That has been the lifeline for the African-American community, not only in Portland, but across the land, particularly in our larger communities. It's never an easy challenge. And what Martin Luther King would have us focus on is to be ever vigilant about your rights and your responsibilities. We can't always, as August Wilson say, see ourselves as a victim or a virgin. We lost our virginity when we sold some of our brothers into slavery way back in the 1500s. And we can't afford to see ourselves only as victims, but we must be advocates. And Martin Luther King would point to his struggle and the struggle of from the little girls in Birmingham and from the people that faced the fire hoses and the dogs during the 60s, as well as those who have faced trying to get President Obama elected, that there is always going to be a struggle. Nothing comes easy. And you must be prepared in order to struggle. And in order to be effective in your struggle, then you must be organized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's focus just for a moment on education. You being an educator yourself, No Child Left Behind, for example, getting into somewhat of specifics here, what do you think was the benefit of that program, or how did that program benefit the African-American community, or did it indeed benefit the members of the African-American community?
Well, it's hard to say just how much benefit accrued to the African-American community in particular. The one thing that it did do, it pointed to higher standards. And it pointed to having elevating the expectations for people, particularly for our young people, and organizing metrics that in some cases were much harder to achieve. But in reality, there have been many programs that have come and gone. Thankfully, the Title I program has stayed, and we were privileged to be affiliated with Congressman Augustus F. Hawkins, who drafted the legislation which became the Elementary Secondary Education Act in Title I. But we've had a series of interventions and a series of mood swings, I might call it. But at the core of it is quality teachers in a public school system that is governed and run by people who have the interests of all the children and not the interests of a special interest group at the forefront of their agenda.
So when we look at curriculum, there's a movement on that constantly talks about more inclusion in the curriculum in terms of African American history. Do you see that as being an important piece?
Absolutely, absolutely. I have a friend, a colleague of yours, Brother Muhammad in San Francisco, and he said to me one day, he says, "Hey, Chappie," he said, "I see you're in Ebony Magazine." I said, "Oh, I didn't know that." He said, "Oh, yeah, you haven't seen the article?" I said, "No." He said, "You want to walk down here to my car with me? I'll show it to you." So I said, "Sure," and I walked down. We got about 30 steps. He said, "Chappie, you ain't in no Ebony Magazine. But look how interested you were when you thought you were part of the curriculum." Mm-hmm. And if we look at the pattern of our youngsters, the kind of films that they like to watch, the kind of shows that they're attracted to, the reason that there is a BET that is able to sustain itself, the way that Tyler Perry's films hit hit the box office and outdo films that have larger budgets. Likewise with Spike Lee and great films, and not to mention August Wilson and his great plays and the plays that come in the theater, in the black theater. We just don't get enough exposure. And that's our fault. That's the advocacy of African American educators. I'm happy to be affiliated with the National Council on Educating Black Children, as well as the National Alliance of Black School Educators. But even there, it's been a struggle both internally and externally. But they continue to deliver product. They continue to deliver conferences, and they continue to deliver strategies that can be effective for urban schools. And we shifted just a little bit to help get away from the racial stereotypes by focusing on the children that have the greatest need. And if you go along economic lines, you're not going to leave African-American children out. But if you focus on children that have the greatest need, you're definitely going to include African-American children. And one of the things, it's a crisis for the whole United States in that we have squandered so much of our human capital trying to hold people back, trying to limit opportunities only to the privileged few, that now, you know, they've got people all over the globe who are coming to the United States as engineers. I'm talking about competent electrical engineers, mathematicians, scientists who have had their training in India and in China who are going to eat up the job just because we have failed to prepare our youngsters here. We would just as soon have them fit the stereotype, end up in the juvenile court system, end up in the prison system, end up in the probation network where they always are subject to that. Mm-hmm. And the change has to come from within. In other words, the change has to be that what would happen, Brother Hamid, if our youngsters decided, I'm just not going to jail. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to be a problem. I'm not going to allow myself to miss the opportunity. There are a number of people, and you can go to the colleges, makes a good example, whether you go to Reed College, Lewis and Clark College, University of Portland, or even Portland State and our public universities, and you have people there who are striving. And the private colleges, whether it's $45,000 or $50,000 a year, are bulging at the seams. So it brings it back to the economics of being able to provide an education and the willingness of our larger society. And that's why when you hear all this talk about government is too big and that they recognize, somebody recognizes, it's a very sophisticated way of looking at it, that 70% of African Americans work for the government. Mm-hmm. Whether they work for the county, the city, whether they work for law enforcement or public schools, that's where our employment is. And as they talk about shrinking government and as they talk about government having too much a role in our society, what they really are saying, and it goes all the way back to the Reconstruction era, when you pull government out, you also pull people out of the employment sector. So there is a segment of our population which really doesn't want our children to succeed. And Congressman Hawkins put it to me this way, the late Congressman Hawkins, what do you do with a slave when you no longer need his labor? And that's the question that is on the table right now. That's the question that we must answer. Other people are trying to answer it for us, but we must answer our own questions. And we need leadership at every level, in every dimension, and it takes courage.
Yes, it does, and it's a question that has been pending since the 1800s. You know, what do we do with a slave? Interesting that we are making this analogy when the Lincoln movie is doing so well with Steven Spielberg, his portrayal of Abe Lincoln.
I haven't heard enough about that movie. I went to see it myself. I think it should be seen twice. There are some really great and old historical documentary films that put the question of slavery in the proper perspective. Mm-hmm. But we need to study the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and simply take seriously our opportunity to be in the mainstream.
Absolutely. I just want to just move on just for a minute. The Dr. King, I think, in his life kind of realized that the whole area of segregation was kind of deeper than just the surface things that like sitting at the back of the bus and all those things, particularly when he went north to Chicago, and he recognized that that racism was prevalent in the North as well, maybe a little more subtle, but nevertheless, there. When we look at gentrification, for example, was integration worth it? Was that the goal? And is that still a goal? And when we look at,
well, integration was a strategy for equality. Mm-hmm. We did not know that integration was going to lead to all the diverse paths, the busing programs, and so forth, because there's always been resistance to integration.
Mm-hmm.
We were striving for equality. We sought equality. We got integration and desegregation. But if the and now it's coming full circle where you have much more discussion. I don't know if we have how much, what kind of metrics we're using to measure progress, but the idea of equity is on the table, and every community and every city council and county commission has an equity program. The public schools have an equity initiative. But it's up to us to help them define that and to monitor its implementation so that the results can be effective, can improve the quality of the community. And I wouldn't, although I'm not an economist and not very well versed in economics policies, but we do have groups like the African American Chamber of Commerce, and there is opportunity with them as in partnership with the county and with the city to monitor equity programs and make sure that opportunities in the business world. You know, when I travel, I listen to people talking. And people want to know, well, what do you do? What do you do? But when I overhear European Americans, they basically are talking about their business and what businesses they're going into, whereas our students are geared up toward getting a job and becoming employed. It's a mindset that if we were going to do anything in the curriculum, in addition to enriching the culture, enriching
the history
and the literature, and if people are uncomfortable with Black history, because what it's going to do, it's going to raise that question.
Right.
But the way to access people being feeling more inclusive and educating all of the community, not just the Black kids, but all the community, is through African American literature. That can be a great window, because the literature is great. The literature is abundant. It's rich. And it focuses on that one thing that everybody has to master, and that is the English language, at least here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just really quickly, I know we don't have a lot of time, Michael, and we have so much to discuss. Dr. King, I think many would give him credit in terms of looking at President Obama's election and our whole movement in terms of politics and so forth. Do you think that he would, if he were alive today, Dr. King was alive today, would he give President Obama a free ride, or do you think we are giving him a free ride, or how would you address that whole question?
Well, it's hard to extrapolate or try to speak for Dr. King in the way that he would interpret the election of President Obama. Certainly, it's a milestone. Certainly, it's an incredible achievement, one that we couldn't even have envisioned, even when we believed that all men are created equal and that with a level playing field, this thing could be achieved. And we used to tell kids, they used to tell me, you can grow up and be president. We knew that was nonsense until it happened, and we realized it. But as far as giving him a free pass, nobody gets a free pass. You don't get a free pass. You can't come to the studio late. I don't get a free pass. I can't speed on the freeway. You don't get a free pass. And Martin Luther King would, although he would celebrate the achievement, he would be expecting the office of the president to do its job. And I happen to think that he is doing his job. There are a lot of people who don't like the fact that he has had as much success as he has had. And if we were to enumerate, and I've seen a couple emails that do enumerate his achievements and the things that he has actually done, we see what comes across the news, but there are a lot of things, and a good portion of what is being done or what has been done is creating a mood, mm-hmm. creating a lifting the spirit of people in America, because it wasn't only African Americans that voted for President Obama and got mm-hmm. him elected, especially for a second term. Mm-hmm. The American people got sense. But the main achievement that he had, that he can be credited for, and that what I think Martin Luther King would credit for, is that he has galvanized the idea that a Black man is an American. And mm-hmm. being an American, He is entitled to all of the rights and privileges that go with that citizenship, and President Obama being elected is proof that he is first an American. And as such, being an African-American, a black man in the White House, it changes things incredibly. Mm-hmm. Now, where it needs to change is in the election of our representatives in various states who will be represented in Congress and in the Senate. And but you have to have an agenda that helps all people. And I think that's what, while you might find some individuals that are in the media, African Americans, who think that he's not doing his job and we'd just be better off with President Clinton or whatever, is nonsense. The fact is that it's a big job. It's a difficult job. It's a balancing act, like walking on a high wire between the Twin Towers. Mm-hmm. Rest they soul.
Right. Yeah, right. As you mentioned, you know, we are Americans, and even if Donald Trump have reservations about the president, nevertheless, the American people did elect him for a second term. And
it's acclaimed. Well, we don't hear much about it. I think we're obligated as people in a community that have a concern, a stake in the community, to read more widely. We don't read the papers that come out of London. We don't even read the papers that come out of Detroit and Philadelphia. And I like to zero in on some of their editorial pages. There's some great comments, and there's a world level of morale that has been boosted with the election of President Obama, because it said to a world that has been doubting and does in many ways doubt the credibility of the United States, that the people in America do have some sense. They do have equality in their ranks and on their lips and in their agenda. Mm-hmm. So,
and they are committed to the unity of the human being. So, I think you're right. Locally, how have things changed locally? We know Lou Frederick, I think, is about the only African American in Salem now. We did have Margaret Carter and Ava Gorley. They've since retired.
Well, it's tough sledding.
How do you feel about
it? I commend Lou Frederick and also Loretta Smith at the county level. I think if there were work that needs to be done, and I commend the evolution of the Portland African American Leadership Forum, which now seems to be a congress of people across the city. But it's tough sledding because they want to take leadership and find ways to interface with city council, interface with the county government. We have two worlds here in Oregon. One is an urban world in Portland, and then you've got a very large rural area from Roseburg, Medford, Klamath Falls, East Oregon, and they have interests too. They have their elected officials down in Salem. They don't see things the way that we see things. They don't see the needs of poor people in the same way that we see the needs of poor people. And then August Wilson, I keep referring to him because he's such a powerful voice in my experience and in my world, that he points out to the linguistic environment that we exist in, and all this, you know, reference to black this and white that, and then the absence of it. I'm looking at some of the football contests and the bowl games, you know, and I'm looking at the role of African-American college football players, you know, filling stadiums. People are coming there to be entertained and watch these guys really perform. They don't get a slice of the pie. Mm-hmm. And at the professional level, it's the same thing. Looking at one of the games and see the owner's boxes, you know, it's a whole different story. But it is what it is. And it's our job to work with what we've got and to do what we can. Mm-hmm. I don't want to miss opportunity to point out, not only keep alive the dream, but invite people to come out to our new location at the New Beginnings Conference Center on 172nd and Sandy Boulevard. This year will be our 28th year. Ken Berry is at the helm, and he knows what he's doing. We wouldn't have been able to do it successfully for 27 years we didn't have Ken Berry. But it all comes back here to KBOO. About George Page and the DJs currently. I was asking about Eugene Rashad. You know, the role that you are playing. And just having a periodic program, weekly programs that focus on and point to the people with the greatest need. Why aren't there more programs, whether they're African-American DJs or hosts, or whether they're people who recognize? It can't be just African-Americans that advocate for righteousness and advocate for virtue and advocate for equality and equity in our society. And while we're at it, looking at calendar.
Yes, absolutely.
Portland people should know that the All Aboard, which is an installation of railroading in Black Portland is going to go into the Oregon Historical Society starting on the 15th of January and run through April. That's going to be an excellent opportunity for people to come together and for all people to see the history of blacks in Portland, particularly as it's centered around the railroads.
Right, and the hotel situation.
Yep, well, we've resurrected the Golden West Hotel.
We resurrected the Golden West, and looking forward to the official opening of that area.
I want to give a shout out to a guy named Dr. Bob Zyback. He's a classmate of mine from back in high school. Will Bennett really picked up where Bob Zyback left off, and that is to keep the mirrors reflecting and the light shining on the Golden West Hotel as an entity of historical significance in our city.
Well, I'm sorry that, I'm so glad that he's doing that, and we need more of our history being shown to our youngsters and so forth, and knowing their responsibility and letting them know what their responsibilities are as well. Listen, I want to thank you, Michael, for coming down today. We didn't get enough chance to really talk as much as I would like to a man who has the storehouse of knowledge as yourself.
Just a school teacher. Well studied, and I got a lot of great mentors. And we use a little phrase that says teamwork makes a dream work. And what that encourages is collaboration among people that you don't spend much time with. We need one another, and together and united, we can get a lot of things done, particularly for those people that don't have the voice that we might have.
Absolutely. The event, Keeping the Dream Alive?
Keep Alive the Dream.
Keep Alive
and
the Dream.
And this year's theme is Standing on the Shoulders.
Standing on the Shoulders.
Yeah, we're quick to say that not only do we stand on the shoulders of those who have come before us, we stand on the shoulders of those who are among us.
We stand on the shoulders of those who are among us as well. And thank you so much. And it's the 19th or the 21st.
It's on the holiday. It's we call it a holiday. Day on, not a day off.
Not
it's
a
Monday,
day off.
January the 21st, and we'll be at the New Beginnings Conference Center, which is different from the Highland Christian Center, where it has been the last couple of years.
Right.
And Pastor Hardy is making sure that his flock and all of his contemporaries, you know, head out to the New Beginnings Conference Center, a fabulous venue for the program that will be televised and simulcast here on Cable Radio.
Here on Cable Radio. And is it going to have the African Village this year?
It will have the Dreamers Village. Yeah, so they'll have vendors, a basic bazaar for people who want to come pick up products from the film to art to food. And it'll be a great celebration. We call it a day on, not a day off. So don't you dare take a holiday. Go work for Martin Luther King one way or another. And we will be there tomorrow. It'll be the last day for people to sign up as volunteers on Saturday tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Tomorrow they'll be there. Okay. Michael Chappy Grace, thank you so much, sir, for taking time out of your schedule to come down to these studios today. And we look forward to, again, broadcasting the event and doing what we can to promote all of the wonderful values that you and Ken Berry tried to build.
Well, please know that we have a whole team of people that make it happen. Ken and I are simply riding in the captain's chair. We take responsibility when it goes wrong.
All right. Okay, for It Takes a Village, I'm Shahid Hamid, and thank you all for listening. I will see you the first Friday of next month when we maybe take a look at hopefully the Golden West Hotel and some of the things that we've talked about today.
You got time for a 10-second plug?
Yes.
Javier Nero, the great young trombone artist, is going to be performing on Saturday night at Ivory's and Ivory's Jazz Club in Portland. So I think it's January 6th. If people don't want to miss that, they get an opportunity to come on down.
Okay. Until next time, I'm Shahid Hamid. Peace. We're out.
Peace.
Blitz. Rappin' black.
Rappin' black. Rappin' black. Rappin' black.
You're listening to KBOO's Morning Radio Zine. I'm your host, Carlos Chavez. Some have finally come to realize that, like Gil Scott-Heron and the Last Poets of the East Coast, the Watts Prophets were a major influence on the important culturally artistic movement called hip-hop. Unfortunately, many still aren't aware. With their raw, rhythmic, and brutally honest oration, the Watts Prophets set the tone for what their successors on the West Coast would know as rap. Golden era hip-hop pioneers like Ice-T, DJ Quick, Dr. Dre, and hosts of others would sample and draw from the sharp poetic works of three young men out of Watts named Otis O'Solomon, Richard Dido, and Omdi Hamilton. Their poetry weaved together the raw realities of life in South Los Angeles during the 1960s with conscious, thought-provoking messages that addressed institutional racism and integration, with reflective and critical perspectives on topics like political romanticism, class, and masculinity. Omdi Hamilton's piece, Pimpin', Leanin', and Fiendin', is one of those heavily honest and influential pieces that blend poetic rhythms with the very harsh realities of Watts' poor and tough community.
Pimpin', leanin', and fiendin'. Some say I'm dreamin', but I know I'm schemin'. Scufflin' and hustlin', slippin' and slidin'. Always hidin', heats around underground. Hangin' blacks in the courts, hustlers tryin' to stay off them white folks' jail reports. Pimpin', leanin', and fiendin'. White folks cold, black folks gettin' bold. Like let's blow up the world and send everybody to the moon in a